Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, Park fans. We are a podcast for theme park fans. If you're new here, you're very welcome. Hopefully you're a bit of a theme park nerd as well, and you will enjoy our nerdy theme park chat. I'm Bex, and I'm joined today by a lovely lady called Hayley Field, and we are discussing what on earth can you do with a problem like RAP. The Ride Access Pass system. Obviously, there's been a lot of focus on it recently, mainly from the Merlin side of things. We are going to go into detail on that and talk about what we could do, what could be done better. Is there a solution, or are we just going to be going back and forth on these conversations forever? Because to me, it doesn't look like there's an easy solution. But Hayley, welcome to Parkcast.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah, we're very, very welcome here. And you are a parent of a child with special educational needs.
Yeah. So, yes, for anyone who isn't familiar with myself. So, yeah, I'm Hayley Field. I am a wife. I'm a full-time working mum to two boys, one of whom is autistic. I own my own travel business and specialise in making travel accessible to everybody, especially neurotypical families. We have our social media and YouTube channel. You can find us at The Field Trips, and we capture our holidays and our days out, mainly of which are theme parks.
I think a lot of us listening are in exactly the same boat. We sort of think, should we go and do something? No, we're back to a theme park again.
We considered, like, oh, maybe should we go on holiday to Spain next? No, we're going back to a theme park.
They always win out, don't they? But it is the way when you've got children. Obviously, I've got a young daughter myself, and sometimes it's not just for us. You know, we might be big theme park fans, obviously I am, that's very clear, but when you know that they're going to have a good time somewhere, that also takes some of the stress off as a parent. Like, I'm not going to have to worry too much. I know they're going to enjoy it.
Definitely. So I worked at a theme park for 9 years. I met my husband there, I met my best friends there. So
did
it's very
you?
Much ingrained in our life. Everything that exists now started from a theme park. So it's, yeah, I kind of started my career there and grew up in that industry. So by default, my kids don't really have a choice. But they love it. They love it. We're not putting them there kicking and screaming. They thrive off it. So we are very much a theme park family. Even when we try to move away from it, we always creep back. So,
yeah. I can totally empathise with that. Which theme park were you working in? Can you say?
So I worked at Thorpe Park for 9 years. Yeah.
In what sort of Thorpe era?
So I was there from 2008 to 2015.
Okay. Oh, so that was quite a busy time.
It was, yeah. So I left very, very shortly after the Smiler incident in 2015. So that was, a challenging time. I worked numerous roles across my career there. So everything from ticketing to customer service to retail to park operations management. So it's very much, it started, I think even now, like, I've moved away from that industry now, but I think even the core skills that I learned there apply to everything that I do now. So we love theme parks, and I've still got a lot of friends that work at theme parks, so it's still very much in conversation every day.
It's amazing how many people have been on this podcast who work in the attractions industry and who started the same. You know, they started as a ride up or on the ticket office or things like that, and a lot of them have obviously stayed in the industry and have now gone, like, whoa, way up the tree and in senior management positions. But they all say the best grounding you can get is working at a theme park and doing those kind of roles, because you do come across every kind of problem and you have to learn how to solve them, and you see the best and the worst of human nature at theme parks. I think people are trying to have a good day out, and it doesn't always go to plan. We know that.
No, it is. I think also, when you work in that kind of industry, like any sort of hospitality industry or leisure industry, it's all consuming, because you work so many hours and it very much consumes your life, which hence why all of my best friend group, we're still best friends, and all of our husbands, we all met working at the park. It's all consuming, and I think that's quite hard to step away from. Like, once you've been in that and you are consumed by it, it's very hard to then, even if you do physically step back in terms of a career change or whatever, it's still very much who you are as a person, and it's very much still a, you know, a special interest for me and my family, absolutely.
Yeah, it's in your blood. You
It
can
is.
never
It
get
is.
away.
Don't.
Okay. So talk to me about becoming a mum. So obviously that was your background and you loved theme parks yourself, you worked in them, you became a mum, and
Yeah.
whenever any of us become a mum, we never expect that we're going to have anything other than the perfect fairy tale parenthood existence that we all get brought up seeing. But obviously none of us get that. There is always going to be an issue somewhere along the line, or something that's unexpected that throws itself up. And for you, it was obviously finding out that your son had autism. Was that a shock? Were you aware from a very early age?
I think I was very, we were very aware from a very early age. But I think that is quite rare to be that aware. So, yeah, so I've got two boys. I've got Jesse, who's six, he's autistic. And then I've got Henley, who's four, and he is, as far as we're aware, neurotypical. And with Jesse, it was very, very textbook in that around 12 months of age, he wasn't hitting milestones and he'd done a very obvious regression. So it was very textbook in that he had speech, then he lost speech, lots of things like walking on tiptoes, flapping. So if you were to Google autism, we
Yeah.
could almost like tick it off and go, okay, he's got this, he's got this, he's got this. So we started his pathway to diagnosis at about 18 months old, and we got him diagnosed at two. So that is very, I appreciate that's very early in terms of what is, you know, normalized from in terms of diagnosis. But yeah, it was, as I say, very, very very obvious, very clear regression. So it was quite easy. I don't know if that's the right term to use, but it was quite easy for us to go in terms of being able to demonstrate what he could and couldn't do. It was very textbook. So yeah, and then we had, when he was two, that's when we had Henley. So he's our first child, and that's all we've ever known, in terms of from a parenting aspect. And then, yeah, and then we had Henley, who was the complete opposite. And I think you never have two children the same. So I'm sure everyone
No.
who's got multiple children will know. You think you've nailed it, you think you know what you're doing as a parent, and then the second one comes along and you go, I know nothing. So that's very much, yeah, very much been, yeah. So every theme park that we've ever visited, or any day out that we've ever visited, we've always had to put adaptions into place to be able to cope with that, because we knew from such an early age, we didn't know what he could cope with and what he couldn't. Of course, we've had to learn that along the way, but we did know that we would have to put adapt, like, you know, we would have to adapt our day and put things in place and prepare maybe a little bit differently, because we did know at an early age, that
Okay.
he, you know, he had these challenges.
Yeah. So looking at those adaptations from a young age, obviously we'll talk about the Merlin Ride Access Pass system, which actually is, I mean, it's evolved so much in the last couple of years anyway. It's nothing like it started out as, but that wasn't even a thing probably 10 years ago. But what, as a parent, what sort of things did you immediately think, whether you're at a theme park or not, what do you need to think about when you're taking an autistic child for a day out?
Firstly, I just want to say everything that I talk about today is obviously from my perspective as a parent. So I'm going to use probably the terminology child or children a lot, but obviously this is relevant to children, adults, you know, whoever uses the parks, who is, you know, maybe neurodiverse and needs to use it differently. But for us, in terms of preparation is everything, and it really is. And we really do, both from, you know, a personal standpoint, but also in terms of process standpoint, you have to prepare so much to be able to enjoy these days. From a process standpoint, of course, you know, you need to apply early. You need to make sure that you've got, and I can talk to this in more depth as we come on to the Merlin stuff, but you need to obviously have like your Nimbus card. You need to have done all of that. You need to, you know, pre-book your day out and stuff. And they suggest, you know, a week in advance or 3 months in advance, but realistically, you're talking maybe 6 months in advance if you want to secure the date that you want. So there's that process element of preparation, but then there's also the personal element of preparation, where you need to expose your child to what this is. So that might be things like watching YouTube and watching ride clips again and again and again, identifying accessibility maps, so where things are for you, because you might not be able to use a normal toilet. You might need a toilet where you've got more space, or that has certain equipment in it and things like that. So you need to know where those are. You need to know what's coming up on a ride. Is it loud? Do they pump it with smells? Is there lots of lights? How long is the ride duration? What do they use in it in terms of visuals? Is that going to be a trigger? Is it not? So there is so much in terms of preparation that I think you need to do to be able to just have no surprises. But the beautiful thing about theme parks is once you know that, there tends to be no more surprises because theme parks are one of the only places where not much changes in terms of you could go back again and again. It's the same layout, it's the same ride system, it's the same smells as you had before, it's the same noises in the same place. So from that aspect, once you've got it, it's a brilliant place to keep going back to again and again and again because it's not changing in that sense. So I think for autism families, and there is sort of one thing that I think there's a perception, and the perception, and I understand it completely. The perception is that theme parks might seem like the worst possible place to go if you have autism or if you have an autistic child. They are loud, they are busy, there are crowds, there are queues that sometimes seem to go on for forever. And for some autistic children, some of the time that can be genuinely hard, and that is true. But I think what a lot of people don't realise is that every autistic child is individual. It's a spectrum, and that means that children experience the world in very, very different ways. Some kids can be very oversensitive. Sounds can feel very loud. Lights can feel too bright. Everything can feel too much. But there is a huge, huge number of autistic children and adults where actually they're the opposite, and their nervous system is actually undersensitive. So it's called hyposensitive, and that basically means that they are craving inputs that they wouldn't normally get in everyday life. So intense movement, spinning, speed, noise, color, their brain actively seeks it, and that helps them to feel regulated and feel calm. So there is, of course, a science behind this, and this is, without getting too technical, it's basically like it's part of the inner ear, so it helps control their sense of balance and movement and space around them as well. So for children who are undersensitive, their system essentially is running empty on everyday life because they're not getting that, and they're not getting enough input. And intense movement, swooping, spinning, dropping, accelerating, those kinds of things, they feed off it. So when you might see, maybe an autistic child on a roller coaster and it looks like they're in absolute heaven, that's not an exaggeration. Genuinely, their brain nourishes off that experience. And it's very rare to be able to get that in any other environment. So for me, for Jesse, he might want to go on the same ride 17 times in a row. And not him being difficult, that is his brain literally drinking on like what is happening, and every time round he is coming off a little more settled, a little more regulated, and it's quite hard to sort of think, because for the likes of you and I, we'll get that adrenaline rush, we'll get the like come off maybe a bit shaky and just thinking, especially if it's a spinning ride for me, I come off and think, oh no. Whereas he is thriving off that, and that is so special. And I think also that combined with special interests, which I think is something that people don't talk about enough.
Absolutely.
I think it's something crazy, like over 95% of autistic people will develop a special interest. And these usually start as a child and, can last a lifetime. For Jesse especially, they keep coming back round. In fact, I can't get rid of anything because suddenly this special interest has come back round. But yeah, I mean, for them, a special interest, it's not just like a hobby, it's the core of who they are as a person. It brings them comfort, it brings them identity, a real sense of joy. For Jesse especially, like he will talk in scripts, and these scripts are from his special interest, so they might be shows or characters, things like that, and that's how we communicate with him. And common interests normally, I'm sort of generalizing here, but they tend to be things like specific worlds or themes or animals, vehicles, music, For Jess again, it's anything with wheels, anything that moves. And that's what a theme park is, right? It's literally a physical world built entirely around these things. So, when a child is combining the two, so the sensory input that they desperately need, combined with the character that they love, or the theme that they love, it's that's sort of where the magic happens. That's like a full body, experience for them, that their two worlds are combining, and they can scream on a ride and it doesn't look odd, or they can talk the ear off a car, to a cast member about a special interest that they have, and that's all, that's a place where they can do that and be accepted for doing that. It's basically just a combination of just the closest things of joy that exist for them in one place. And I think that is why theme parks, especially for children, adults with autism, are such special places, and places that we go back to again and again and again and again, because it's those things combined. And for me as well, it's also a bonding experience with my son. Like, I can't get much out of him when I'm taking him to places that aren't necessarily designed for him, like school, supermarket, even birthday parties. He doesn't cope well in those situations, and we especially can't bond in those situations. I couldn't have a conversation with him about school. He would never, I couldn't say, how was your day? And he would tell me, like, he's not able to do that. But what I can talk to him about, and what we can relive moments on, is days out in theme parks where he's combined his special interest with, being on a ride, getting those feelings. And we can, it's a bonding experience for us. We can share that together, and we can relive those moments and talk about it. And we don't get a lot of that. So that is so special, to be able to sit and have a conversation with my son about that ride that he's just been on, or that character that he's just met, for example. It's special.
I mean, and as a parent, that's all you want for your child, isn't it? It's to see them having a great time and doing something that they love and they enjoy. And for you to really, I suppose, see him come out of his shell and become almost a different person when he steps through the gates of a theme park, that must be, really magical for you. And I guess the only issue for you is what comes with a theme park is queuing. And I'm going to make an assumption here that Jesse doesn't do great in a queuing situation, despite his love of being on the ride and his love of being in the theme park itself.
And you're absolutely right. We will do so much preparation. We will watch ride POVs. I have got so many park maps around my house that would like he will sit and he will study, and he will know where things are. So we do so much preparation. But if you then get to that park and you have to stand in a, for him, it's a crowded corridor. It's full of lots of noise, people he doesn't know. It's not safe. It's unfamiliar. He can't see an end in sight. He doesn't know what's coming. He actually really doesn't cope well with any form of pre-show either. If there's any ride with a pre-show, we have to really front load him with what that is. And if we can get a POV of it on YouTube, that works perfectly, because if he can't anticipate what's coming next, he will not be able to cope with that. So when you are then put in a queue line situation, you undo all of that preparation within minutes. And for him, it's not just that, he wants to get on quick. He physically cannot cope with all this unknown and all this, everything that is out of control. And for him, it's so much amplified for what might be loud for us, and I'm generalizing here, but for a neurotypical person, what might be, a bad smell, or people acting in a way that you're not sure how what they're going to do next, or that is so much that is amplified for him. And if he ever feels unsafe, that can almost lead to a state of crisis. So, and if he has a meltdown, that's it. Like, typically the day's over, there's no coming back from it. So it's not just about being able to get on things quickly and get on as much as we can. It's make or break.
I can't imagine. I mean, I've got a daughter who will have a toddler tantrum, and she within 10, 15 minutes we can sit her down and she's back and she's on with her day. She might not be having a great time, but she can bring herself back down from that. I can't really imagine a situation where you're like, well, we have to go home now. And that's also difficult, I guess, on your other son if you get to that point, because then he misses out as well. So I can see, you know, why you would absolutely need to avoid getting to that situation. We will talk about the Merlin Ride Access Pass system. We will also talk about other parks as well. So this isn't going to be all about Merlin, but obviously Merlin is the big one that has been the focus of everyone's
Hot off
attention
the press,
recently.
yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can't not talk about it. I would love someone from Merlin to talk about it, but that's just not going to happen. But you are a user of it, so this is your experience, and this is how these changes have affected you. So I guess you have been a Merlin Ride Access Pass user since before the old new system where you had to pre-book. So you were the old user where you could essentially turn up on the day and get a ride access pass if you wanted one.
Yes, yeah. And at that point, we had Merlin passes because it worked for us as a family. And it was great. Like we could, you know, on a Lego, as I'm sure it is for many, is a special interest for Jessie. And we're very lucky that we're local to, you know, Thorpe Park, Legoland, Chessington. We could on a Sunday go, wake up and go, which one should we go to today? And like we were going to a Merlin park once a week, basically, you know, give or take. And it was brilliant. Like we would have to do the same rides in the same order. It got a bit boring for me and James. We were like, should we just try? No, we're not. We had to stick to the routine, of course. But it was great. Like we, you know, we could do that. And then the pre-booking system come in, and of course I understand why. But it caused some challenges for us as a family because we couldn't be as relaxed as we were. Like when Jesse gets unwell, he can't just fight off a cold like my other son can, for example. It's something like a cold will wipe him out for 3 weeks. So we can't necessarily pre-book in advance 3 months in advance because you get to the day and he's not well, but you feel obliged to go because you've had to pre-book it so far in advance. You go and it's you shouldn't, but you feel like you have to because otherwise you're not going to get to go again maybe this year if you can't get another pre-book slot. And we were finding that like we were in April trying to book for the summer holidays and couldn't. And we were like, at that point we did decide to stop our Merlin passes because it wasn't working effectively for us as a family.
I can see that. I mean, I can't imagine the headache of having to do that. As I've said online, I think on this podcast before, I'm not a wrap user. I've never been a wrap user. I've never had to use it. And to me, that did seem like an absolute nightmare. And the amount of people who I still saw even last year who didn't realize that was the system. So just to be clear, this change happened in 2024, and Merlin then said if you needed a ride access pass, you had to pre-book your visit. They released the dates for the year at the start of the year, and very quickly people would book them all up. There wasn't really any limit on how many you could book, but it was fastest finger first. And a big problem was that people would pre-book a date and then not go because they forgot about it, or they just were pre-booking it because they were panicking and had no intention to go or whatever, which then meant that people who did want to use the ride access pass on those dates weren't able to because those slots were essentially ring-fenced for people who didn't turn up. So that was a bit of a nightmare, I think, for everyone. The only good thing I did hear about it, and you may have had this experience, is that if you were a wrap user with a pre-booked slot, actually the system worked very well on the day. There were no sort of extra long queues or anything like that, because it was very limited. So actually, as a wrap user, if you were able to get a slot, it worked very well, getting the slot. And as you say, the challenges with the pre-booking was the issue with that. And that was the system that they kept in place for 2 years. So 2024 and last season, that was how it worked. They then announced for 2026 they were going to do a new system. So the first announcement was they were going to slow release the wrap pre-booking dates, which I think was a good move, and it was going to at least mean that people weren't booking November dates in February, forgetting that they had them booked, not turning up or whatever. There was going to be a staggered release of dates, and they were also going to release more wrap dates 48 hours before every day. So with 2 days to go, you could say, do you know what, we fancy it, let's try and get a slot. As a compromise, I think that seemed like a decent way to go. And I was interested to see how that was going to play out this year and what the feedback was from wrap users. Unfortunately, we never got that far because within, I think, 2 weeks of them making that announcement, there was then this bombshell, which I'm sure you've heard about it, but if you haven't, it was the most chaotic release of information that I have ever seen as a theme park fan. And it was essentially an email which said, "We are changing who qualifies for wrap. You have been allocated symbols based on your needs. We have basically chosen those for you. We've changed what the symbol was, and it was, I think it was difficulty with crowds and queuing, or something along those lines." And they split it out, and they said it's now going to be difficulty with crowds. Oh no, difficulty standing and
Standing,
difficulty
yeah.
with crowds. And we've split it out, and we haven't asked you which one you qualify for. We've made that decision for you. And if you only qualify for difficulty with crowds, sorry, you're no longer eligible for wrap. And it was literally an email which essentially said, in fact, that was more detail than the email
Yes.
said. I've given a better
That's a much
explanation.
better overview than the actual one, yeah.
And there was no consultation, there was no heads up, no one had no there was no whispers that this was going to happen at all. It was literally a bolt out of the blue. And I know I suddenly had an inbox full of people saying, "Have you seen what Merlin have done with Wrap?" I made a very quick video about it, which went crazy. And very quickly, it was very apparent there was a huge amount of strong feeling from the community about these changes, and it wasn't going well. What was your initial reaction when you heard what was happening?
So, from a personal point of view, we weren't actually directly affected because Jesse had both symbols. So,
Okay.
we could have, as a family, continued to visit as we do. But I was flabbergasted by it because I think people don't realize the effect that would have on somebody. And I think this is sometimes the misconception of wrap. It's not a fast track. It's not, you are waiting the queue. You are just doing it in a conventional way that you're able to cope with. So for me, this was a quality. Like, what you're doing is you are taking away from people a resource that allows them to enjoy their day like everybody else. And I think it's important to say as well, this isn't just a nice thing to have from theme parks. Like, the leisure industry, or all attractions, they don't just do this because it's a nice thing to do. It's law as well. There is an Equality Act that basically says you have to make these allowances to allow people to enjoy the same day out regardless of their challenges. So it's not just a nice to have. Like, it is, there is a law aspect to this as well. But yeah, I think the problem with it, obviously, was A, the communication, the shock of it, the amount of people that had booked or had passes that instantly were, almost disqualified from being able to attend. And that sounds dramatic, but it's really not. Like, if you don't have this in place, you simply, it's not that you can't just enjoy it, you cannot do it. Like, there is no way, two ways around it.
I know you said you had the standing symbol as well, so you would still qualify. If you didn't have that, would you say Jesse would not be able to go to a theme park if he wasn't
Sim
able to have wrap?
yeah, there's simply no way. There's simply no way. Especially, and this is now going to come across derogatory against Merlin, but especially Merlin Parks, because there are, if I use Poulton's as an example, there are other things to do there. There are so many areas outside where you can go and eat as a family. There's a soft play. There is a park on every corner, which is really great for, for families when, they're having to wait that time, but the child still needs that sensory input. Great, they can go whizzing down the slide, they can go on a swing. Like, there's so much else. There are, animals to go and look at. There's other areas. There's, entertainment aspects. The food offering is good, so you don't mind going and sitting in a restaurant and spending the money on a coffee and cake because you're going to get a nice coffee and cake. There's so much other stuff that makes it, if if you can't do all of the rides, if you ha if the queues are too long, you there are there's choice. At majority of the Merlin attractions, you don't have that choice. If you're not in a queue, you are bustling around everyone else, getting to the next queue. There is nothing else, especially when they also, ripped away the entertainment's budget and there wasn't anything going on there, and they've outsourced food options, and it's just not value for money or feasible as a family now in the cost of living crisis, because a day out isn't just park tickets. A day out is park tickets plus another 100+ pounds on food. Like, it's And that's the issue. Like, if Jessie couldn't use that pass, there isn't an alternative for us. There isn't a place to just either continue with the sensory input in a different way or have downtime. There is an option, and that's the challenge.
I know that Merlin have said, well, first of all, they have backtracked on this, which we'll get to as well. But at the time, they said they had put in alternative options for children or anyone, not just children, adults who would have had the difficulty with crowd symbol. So they built a sensory room. They put signage at the start of the ride to say what to expect, like some of the things you're mentioning about, is it loud, is it fast, that kind of thing. They said that they'd put all that up, and they also said they had released footage of what to expect on the rides to watch on YouTube, which obviously you said that is helpful. But I'm guessing that's not enough, from your point of view. Those things are all great and are nice to have, but they can't work in isolation.
The problem, I think, with the Merlin perspective is it shouldn't be and or. Like, it needs to be both. Like, you need to be able to do that preparation just to get there. But to enjoy the day, and not just enjoy the day, but to be able to physically do it, you also need to have the equality part, where you need to be able to have a system in place that allows people to be able to enjoy those rides in a conventional way that works for them. And for a child or adult with autism who cannot, it's not that they don't want to understand the concept of queuing, they cannot understand the concept of queuing. Like, they cannot be confined to those conditions, because they just it's fight or flight. And in those conditions, like, it can be fighting, it can be dangerous. Like, I couldn't put my son in that kind of condition, because he just wouldn't cope. And what would happen as a result of that wouldn't just be unsafe for him, but also for other guests around. Like, it's and I'm not saying my child's a maniac, he's not going to go off and try and hurt somebody, but there are situations that if I continue to put him in a position like that, that is what could happen. So it cannot be, well, we've done this, yeah, but you've also taken away the element that actually allows it to be possible. So yes, we need all of this stuff. Yes, we need to be able to prepare. Yes, we need to be able to know what's coming. That shouldn't be a pat on the back. That should be just what it like. That should be, just what it is. That should almost be mandatory that information is available to people. That's just creating, a good guest experience. But then to take away the actual element that allows them to be there and actually do the day, like, it shouldn't be and or. You have to have both.
Does it frustrate you as a parent? It must have done when you saw a lot of the comments online when RAP was being discussed, and people saying, well, just buy a fast track if that's what you need, or you just well then you can't go. It seemed to me there's a big misunderstanding of the RAP system from regular guests, which in a way, it's not their fault. They don't know how it works because they don't use it. And what they see is the RAP queue, which has got a few people in it and people in the RAP queue getting straight on the ride. What they don't see is the timeout in between where you are timed out from using attractions. Do you think there needs to be more education on that? Is that really frustrating for you that people don't understand how RAP works? Or is it just like, well, that's just one of those things and they're never going to get it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that the attractions have to do more to educate people on this, because, and that's why I'm here. Like, this is what, like I said, we wasn't as a family directly affected by this, but I think it's so important to advocate for everyone who is, because I of course saw the comments, and it is heart-wrenching, and it's so hard to not turn into a keyboard warrior and be like, you don't know. But of course I wouldn't do that. But I think attractions have to do better because I feel it. Thankfully, Jessie lives in Jessie World, so Jessie isn't yet aware. But me and James feel the daggers. Like when you're going up, especially if an exit or ride access pass queue goes alongside the main queue, or you kind of meet at the front and they're about to get on and they can see that the next train's coming, and then suddenly you get on it and they don't. Like you can feel it, you can feel the burns. And I understand, I do, of course I do. Like, I was from that world prior to Jessie. I was never, I never lived this world, and I have a neurotypical child, so I understand, I do. And I do think, of course, I will continue to do things on my socials and things like this to try and educate people, but I think a lot of it has to come from the theme parks. They have to do more to, because it's under talked about, and if people aren't aware of it, then of course they're going to get a pre like a you know a preconception of what is happening. But no one is skipping a queue. We are just waiting it in a time, like afterwards, in an environment that is suitable and safe for us to do so. So yeah, absolutely. I think there is a huge opportunity here for theme parks, to do better. And I think they're missing a huge opportunity as well, because I'm trying to think of the statistics, but there is around, I think it's like 700,000 autistic people in the UK. And no autistic person generally, and again, I'm generalizing here, but no autistic person generally is going to go to a theme park on their own. They're going to go with immediate family or carers or, friends, something like that. So when they are visiting these types of places, because of all the reasons that I talked about earlier, they're bringing people with them. So we're talking like that, if you think about 700,000 people, and then the people that they then might bring with them, or their nearest and dearest, that can be close to like 3 million people. And I'm just kind of, again, I'm generalizing here, but in terms of revenue, we're talking like in the billions a year from this pool of people that they're not trying to exclude, but with if they continued with that, would have excluded. Like we're talking billions of annual spending a year. And those people, if they have a good time, and they're it's accessible to them, and they're going to be the ones that go back again and again and again and again, because they're getting those special interests and that sensory input that I talked about. And in terms of a marketing from a marketing aspect, they're going to be the ones that are like me and my family, putting it all over social media, putting it on YouTube, talking about how fabulous it was and why you should go, creating guides like I do to help other people to go. That's three marketing for these attractions, and a huge market that they're missing out from. So it's not just that, I think they should be educated and doing better by, this, by disabled people. I think they're missing a trick by not.
I think what's interesting is that by them not kind of doing the education bit on how RAP works, I think it's actually going to make things difficult for them when they are now trying to change it. So what they have done is obviously here we go, this is complicated. They announced the change, there was uproar. They then said it's not a change, it's just a trial. It's a trial for February half term. They'd never said it was a trial before. It was now a trial. Within 2 days, it was we're not doing the trial anymore. Nothing's changing. Back to as we were. Pre-book your RAP slots. Your symbols haven't changed. If you were entitled last year, you're entitled this year. You just need to pre-book your slots, and away we go for 2026. And they're going to do some work with industry partners and other groups to try and figure a way to get RAP working better. The problem I think they're now going to have is there was so much spotlight on this decision that A, you had the people who obviously opposed it and said it was dreadful. You then had people coming out of the woodwork saying, well, actually, I don't think RAP's a great thing because it impacts my day because they don't understand how the RAP system works. So if whatever Merlin do with RAP now, they're going to annoy one group of people and there's going to be someone who's not happy with it. So they really, really need to, I think, consider how they approach the RAP system in future, how they can make it fair for those who need to use it, but also for those of us who don't use it, make us understand how it is working and that it isn't a queue jump, and it is just an accommodation to allow people, and a lot of the time children, who need to use a system like that to actually be able to enjoy a day out. I hope they don't forget that bit when they announce whatever it is they are going to announce, which they will announce at some point in the future. I think probably not till the end of the year. They'll say, right, this is how we're going to do wrap from now on. I really, really hope that they explain to people that it isn't a queue jump service and it is simply an accommodation, because otherwise they're going to get backlash the other way, and they're just going to go back and forth, and it's going to be a nightmare for everyone. In your opinion, and I've held my hands up and said, I have no idea how we fix this. It's also well above my pay grade to work out how we fix this. I'm sure there's a highly paid Merlin executive who's got it on their desk right now. What do you see is a way out? Have you been to a park where you're like, actually, it worked really well there, and it seemed to work for not just me as a Wrap user, but for all guests? Is there a solution that you're like, that's kind of gold plated?
I don't think it's a one size fits all type of solution, but I think there's a lot that can be done. And because I actually think you hit the nail on the head when you said the first thing that they need to focus on is getting the operations right.
Yeah.
So we recently went to Poulton's Park, and Poulton's set a really, really good example of their operational standards and their focus on it. And their rides aren't good throughput rides. Like, they're slow children's rides. You're not getting vast quantities of people on that ride quickly. That's not what it is. It's that they run their rides, they're all open, they're running to full capacity, their staff are knowledgeable, and they have other things going on that allows the flow of guests to spread out. So even in, the height of the peak season, you can pick and choose what you go on, but there is options, and that's the key thing. So I think getting operations right is a big thing. I think embracing technology is another one. And again, all of this comes to budget, and that's the thing here. I worked at Merlin. I know that, rides won't open on two trains because they won't bring staff in till later in the day. So this, I know some of these issues. So I know a lot of this comes to budget, but I think also embracing technology is a big one. I feel very strongly about this. I think there is a huge opportunity here. There is very successful virtual queuing systems that are out there. I think Merlin is going in that direction. They certainly was, and then they sort of pulled back on it, and now I feel like they are again. But yeah, this is one thing actually that I do think Poulton's could improve on. So, for example, this is, I don't know if you can see that because I've got my blur on.
Oh
This
yeah.
is the card that we are given to navigate the parks. You can go on like one ride, so every ride you can basically go on once. Nobody should have a card, in my opinion, in 2026. Like, there is so much opportunity. They've got a good app. They just need to invest more to include wrap on it. But yeah, I think technology, a virtual queuing system, obviously that's the way that Disney went with it. It works well for them. I think, there's a huge opportunity for theme parks here in the UK to do that. And especially with, Universal Lumen, there is, that's definitely the way that I think theme parks need to go. So operations is one, investing in technology is another, guest perception has to be addressed.
Yeah.
That's another way to improve it.
What
The
about
top
the
three
queue lines themselves? Because you've said they can feel like a corridor and they can feel very claustrophobic to someone with autism. If the queue lines themselves were more generally open, would that make a difference? Would that help? You've mentioned the pre-show, like that your son doesn't like going to a pre-show. If there was an option to
Yeah.
skip pre-shows, would that help?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, an investment into queue lines would definitely help. I know Disney has its own challenges when it comes to their DAS pass, but the sort of the route, in my opinion, that Disney took is they worked on their queue lines. They expanded them so that if you, for example, might be Physically disabled, so you're in a wheelchair, but you can absolutely understand the concept of queuing. You just physically can't stand for a long period of time. You can now take your wheelchair all the way through that queue, allowing the space then for those who don't understand the concept of queuing or physically cannot understand the concept of queuing to therefore use the DAS pass. So there is absolutely an opportunity there for that. It could also be that I've seen people taking big disabled pushchairs and double buggies and stuff like that through queue lines. That would help, like having a safe space, your own space, your comforts, everything you need to be able to take that right up to the ride entrance. Yes, that could be an alternative solution, definitely. I don't think it is the complete solution. You couldn't, like, for example, I couldn't put Jesse in his pushchair for an hour. Like, that's not gonna be the solution. But I think there is opportunity there. I think, yeah, to work on queue lines would be a huge thing. But also, there's so much opportunity in terms of virtual queuing, but it's just having, I suppose, the capacity and the layout of the park to accommodate for that. If people aren't in the queue lines, where are they? So you need to have both. You need to be able to, almost have your entertainment and have other opportunities around the park. Whether that be in your food outlets, whether that be shows, let's say parades, if we're talking about Disney or whatever, there needs to be alternate. It can't just be a theme park. It's called a theme park because it's not just the rides, it's the whole theme, it's the whole attraction. So I think you need to get all elements right, and it's going to take time, it's going to take money, but there is opportunity, definitely.
And I think that is part of the problem is that we have seen, I would say an underinvestment in Merlin parks more recently. I've talked about it online and, not everyone's going to share the same opinion, but I think the ride density of the parks doesn't help matters. You can walk for 10 minutes at Alton Towers and not get to an attraction. It's crazy to me that they'll put a new attraction in, but it always seems to be at the expense of at least removing another one at the same time. We're not building up the density, so we can't soak up the crowds. And you mentioned Poulton's, and there's a park which installed Ghostly Manor, a high throughput dark ride last year, and then this year they're installing a roller coaster. But they're not just building a roller coaster; they're building a flat ride with it as well. It's and I get these things cost money, but Merlin should be one of the premier, or they are the premier theme park operator globally. This is what you spend your money on, right? This is should be what you're spending your money on, attractions and things that make the park experience better for everyone. I know that's a simplistic view, but as you say, all of these elements kind of need to come together to make this work for everyone. And I think there is no quick, right, this is the fix for the rat pass, and everyone's going to be happy with that, because if it was that simple, it would have been done already.
Also, just to add to that, I think if they are going to bring in different attractions within the parks, like I kind of just alluded to, there can't be additional paid for attractions. Like, for
A
example, Alton
dungeon.
Towers, if you then bring in like a dungeons element, but you have to pay for it, and it's like, well, no one's going to go to it then. So that doesn't alleviate the pressure. That doesn't.
Exactly. And having some shows back and some things where you can just take a chill from the queues, I think would make a massive difference. I have said before, this seems to be a problem that specifically really affects the Merlin parks, the ride access pass queue. And I know they're going to have higher footfall than a lot of other theme parks, but they should also have more rides because they are the biggest theme parks. And I don't know why it is such a drama all the time. I know they've said they're working on it, and we're going to have to take them at their word that they are going to be taking some time to really look at this, speak to people who affect, speak to people in the industry, and go, right, how do we actually solve this for better, for good? And we'll have to wait and see what they come back with. It can't be any worse. That's what I've said. It cannot be any worse than what they announced 3 weeks ago. So, I mean, I've said it now, but maybe at the end of the year we'll come back and we'll be like, right, was Bex right? Was it anywhere? We're just going to have to see how it plays out. I really hope that if you are a RAP user, you get to have a good season at theme parks. As I've said before, it's not all about Merlin. There are other theme parks out there. As Hayley said, she's had a great experience at Poulton's. Go to Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Go and support some of the smaller theme parks that, yes, they might not have all the shiny bells and whistles that somewhere like Alton Towers does, but you might find that you actually get a better day out as a family there because you're not having to deal with all of this stress.
Yeah, we also had a really great experience at Drayton Manor as well.
Did
So,
you?
yeah, that was we went last summer, and that was yeah, we had a really great day out there. The
And they
staff were
use the
great, so
Nimbus system as well, which
they
is so
did.
if you're registered for it for the Merlin Pass, you can go and use it there at Drayton Manor, and the same with Blackpool Pleasure Beach as well. And we will wait and see. I think let's reevaluate, let's reconvene when Merlin actually make their decision on how they're going to fix this and see what they have to say. And that's all we can do. Hayley, thank you so much for sharing your experience. I think you've really like shone a light on what the reality is of being the parent of an autistic child who loves theme parks and who just wants to go and visit theme parks, just like we all do. And we just have to find a way to make that work. Before you go, I have one more question for you.
Just gotta ride it.
And this is Just Gotta Ride It. It's the part of the podcast where every time I get a new guest, I put you on the spot and I say, right, every roller coaster in the world's going to get destroyed, but you can save one. I'll be generous. one of them can be saved. Which one are you going to save and why are you going to save it?
Oh, what am I going to save? I think, does it have to be a roller coaster?
Well, look, I've made allowances in the past and I've come under fire for it. What would you say if it wasn't a roller coaster?
Okay, so my all-time favorite ride is Tower of Terror at Disney. That is my
Okay.
all-time favorite. But if it's gonna be a roller coaster, I'm gonna keep it to the UK, and I'm gonna say Nemesis
Yeah.
at Alton Towers. Yeah, Nemesis Reborn. That is, yeah, that's gotta be. That, yeah, I think that's got to be the last time I went on that was straight after breakfast, and I still loved it. So that I think if you can be thrown around at 9 o'clock in the morning on a full stomach and still have the best time when you're in your 30s, then I think it's a roller coaster that's got to be saved.
Yeah, it's such a iconic coaster. We are so lucky to have it in the UK, and so glad that it's been given a new lease of life as well. It's one that's been mentioned a couple of times. It's been saved. It's been ring fenced a few times, so I think it's properly safe now. But yeah, totally appreciate why you say that. Hayley, thank you so much for coming on podcast today. Just remind me, where can we find you online?
Sure. So you can find us on YouTube or on social media at The Field Trips. My inbox is always open. So if anybody has any questions regarding, wrap or, I can help them from talking from experience, then please do message me. But yeah, my advice would be, make sure you prepare, and I can obviously put some stuff out there to tell people how to do that. But thank you for having me on and giving me the opportunity to almost spotlight this and just hopefully just share a little bit of our experience and why we love theme parks and why we just want them to do better.
Yeah, that's what we all want. Thank you so much for coming on. If you haven't already, if you hit that subscribe button, then you won't miss an episode whenever I put a new one out. And if you'd like to leave a review, you can do that as well. For now, though, we've been Parkcast.
Parkcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.